This has been billed as a debate, but unless Vern turns it into one, it won't be a debate. I've prepared a 3-page statement, which he has a copy of, he has seen, and he will find what fault with this he cares to. But I think we both hope that after this, you correct me if this, you don't hope this, that after this, you will raise questions about the applied problem, the problem to which we want to apply the analysis, which is the question of civil disobedience with respect to the civil rights controversy. So I'm just going to go through this statement. Martin Luther King has been called a saint and a blaspheming heretic. He's been called both of these things by Christians. He's been called both of them for the same reason, because he has refused to obey the law. The question is this: may a Christian refuse to obey an unjust law? Now, I'm going to assume that you would all answer yes to that question, because I think each of you admits of the possibility of some law being so unjust, so directly counter to what ought to be done, that the Christian would have no choice but to disobey it. Now, making that, I think, reasonable assumption about the way we all think, we are free to tackle the real problem, which is, how do we decide that a law is unjust and sufficiently unjust that we must disobey it? With what do we compare a duly enacted statute or court decision in order to pronounce it unjust? What is the criterion? There are two kinds of unsatisfactory answer to that question. An unjust law, this is one of them, the purely utilitarian view. An unjust law is a law that doesn't promote the true welfare of mankind. A lot of people will say that. But whose welfare? A law against pickpocketing, for example, does not promote the welfare of pickpockets. Well, you say, well, I don't mean that. I mean the welfare of the greatest number. Well, how great a number? 51%? So that exterminating all cripples and mental incompetence would be a just act? That would benefit the greatest number. And then what is true welfare? The drug addict has an idea of true welfare quite different from the notion entertained by most of us. Or I like Hugh Hefner's, you know, Playboy, his belief that the true welfare of mankind would best be served if every girl gave herself gladly to every male whom she excited in passing. Are we to let some impartial body of experts decide what the true welfare of mankind means? And if we do, what standard will they use? We don't solve the problem, of course, by making somebody else decide it. Especially now that we have seen what manifest cruelties and what rankling injustice can be perpetrated in the name of the scientific administration of society. So the utilitarian view doesn't go down too well. So we can go to the opposite end of the pole. We can say that an unjust law is recognized by comparing it with the natural law. Now, Professor Rieke has criticized this view from a number of angles in the past 2 weeks, but I think he has also caricatured it, and I think he would admit that he's caricatured it. He said that once. I would accept every item in his critique this morning of Pope John's formula for international peace, as well as the previous criticisms of natural law thinking at work, usually by Roman Catholics. But I cannot dismiss the reality, or what I take to be a reality, which is behind this approach to the question of justice, the natural law approach. And I don't really think that Professor Rieke dismisses it either, not as completely as his remarks seem to suggest. Here is the position to which I find myself finally committed: that justice can be spelled with a capital J. There is such a thing. There is a standard. It is a standard in reality. It is something that is real, not a figment of the imagination. It is in the nature of things. A standard which we may consult and do, in fact, attempt to consult in judging the justness or the unjustness of particular positive laws. What this means in practice is, in the first place, that justice is not finally a human creation. It is finally not our judgment, but a judgment upon us. In the second place, if you accept this view, it becomes possible for men rationally to discuss the question of a law's justice, because an objective standard does exist. In the complete absence of any such standard, the discussion could only be emotional. All we could do is browbeat, deceive, manipulate, or finally beat one another over the head. But we could not engage in a genuine attempt to persuade one another of the truth unless a genuine objective standard, the truth, existed somewhere. Now, if you buy what I've said, you haven't really solved any problem. It's relatively easy to assert that justice with a capital J exists, but where does it exist? Up in the sky somewhere? Do you peek in the clouds? Do you look into your heart? Suppose that we all agree it exists and we all agree to consult it. To what library do we go to look up the natural law? Now, since those of you who are unfamiliar with the style of thought in which I'm now going to indulge very briefly, since you will find what I'm about to say horribly obscure anyhow, I'm going to be even briefer than the subject requires. I'm going to indicate only the direction in which I think we must look and how we go about looking, and then comment briefly on the difference which I see between my own essentially natural law position and the natural law position which Professor Rieke has quite rightly, I think, been criticizing these past 2 weeks. And then, very optimistically, I'm going to assume, after having said you won't understand me, I'm going to assume you did, and I'll allow you to draw your own inferences from this position for the question of civil disobedience and civil rights. And if you can't understand what it implies for that question, then I've failed. All right, here it is. Here's what the way I think you gotta go at it. Every person is. Grant that? Watch it. Grant the first one, and I'll get you. Every person who is has being. If you didn't have being, you wouldn't be. You wouldn't is. I mean, there you are. You got is. You got isness. But to be, to have being, you must participate in the ground and power of being, which is the philosopher's name for God. But I want to remain on the level of philosophy and leave out the word God. The rights, the natural rights of every person, derive from and exist by reason of his power to be. The claim which each of us can legitimately, that is, justly, make for himself is proportionate to the power of being which he possesses. Now, this power of being, your power to be, you know what it is if you think. I'm not really just saying words. You've got power to be. Even Don has power to be on the volleyball court. This is not a static, a once-for-all thing. The power of being of an adult ordinarily exceeds that of a child. That of an intelligent person often exceeds that of an unintelligent person, though other factors may well cancel that out. That of a trained, the power of being of a trained and productive person ordinarily exceeds that of an untrained and an unskilled person. In societies, the power of being of nations differs widely. The United States has immeasurably more power of being than the Congo. The nation of Norway has more than the nation of Indonesia. Now, you might wonder where I get that from.
Norwegians.
No. I chose it because I thought it would be relatively non-controversial, but Indonesia is bigger and got more people and got more natural resources. But now reflect upon the reality of the Norwegian people and the Norwegian nation, and then the Indonesian people and nation. Try it for yourself. Of course, the thing is, you have to know something about reality. You can't just look up colored areas on a map. You've got to know the thing that has the power of being. And it seems to me that if you One trouble with us is that we run around counting noses in the United Nations, and everybody counts for one. Afghanistan gets one vote, the United States gets one vote, the USSR gets one vote, Albania gets one vote, as if they all had the same power of being, and they don't. And of course, power implies responsibility. He who has power of being sits in the center of the stage and must accept more responsibility and must therefore be more. The veto in the United Nations is not unethical at all. Well, but because power of being is not static, it is not unchanging, it embraces potentiality. Thus, the child is justly treated when treated as a child, when he is given what is due one with the power of being of a child, plus something more, that which is due him as one who is potentially an adult, containing within himself and his present power to be, the power to become more. Now, I'll make a footnote here. This is where the Christian understanding of love enters in. Love, I think, can be defined and spoken of as creative justice. Justice is giving to every person that which is in proportion to his power of being. Creative justice is giving to him not merely that which is proportioned to his power of being, but that something extra which will transform him, that which will enlarge the power to be, the courage to be, use Tillich's word, of one who is loved. The Christian even may sacrifice his own being, his own power to be. He may give that up in the confidence that he cannot lose it. This is the Christian doctrine of the resurrection. But now, where does what I have said differ from the Roman Catholic position, standard Roman Catholic position on natural law? In two respects, fundamentally. It is more dynamic. That is, it is less present status oriented. It takes more account of potentiality, of what might yet be, and hence is less subservient to the status quo. This is one of the gripes I always have against Roman Catholic moral theologians, that they confuse what happens to be at the moment with what is eternally. Secondly, and most importantly, while confessing that justice is written in the nature of things, this position that I'm taking does not minimize the difficulty of reading it out. Roman Catholic natural law moralists have been, I think, far too flippant with the epistemological question, the question of knowing. I agree with them when they say there is a natural law, but it's amazing how seldom I agree with them when they start reading it. I don't see what they see. I think they have, too quickly, without sufficient hard, searching inquiry, pronounced on the nature of things and the power of being of that which is. They have listened too much to one another, and not enough to Professor Rieke and the whole community of those scholars who are dedicated to the inspection of reality, of nature. Thus, a moral theologian cannot do the task by himself. He cannot construct a natural law ethics. He needs the scientist, using the word now in the broad sense, the student of jurisprudence and economics, to tell him about the nature of reality, the power of being of those structures and societies and people which are, and thereby aid him to construct a definition of justice drawn from the notion of justice with a capital J, given finally by power of being and God, who is the source and ground of being, but enabling him to get down from this abstraction to the level on which we live. The natural law theologian can't do it alone.
You have just heard a most exceptional statement, really. And I wish that each of you had the advantage of... Can you hear me all right? I wish that you had the advantage that I do of having a copy of it before you. Paul was kind enough to type out a copy of his remarks and give me one so that I could work on it. I am almost moved to suggest that it would be a good idea to run our mimeograph machine, Sir Director, and make some copies available. Because it is a good statement. Unfortunately, erroneous.
Oh,
still, it will do very nicely to get around to some other points. When Paul said, watch the first step, of course, this is the one that's dangerous. I remember the story that I'm sure most of you have heard about, the man who was drunk going home and mistook the elevator shaft for the stairway, and went straight down, landed on the bottom and rolled over and looked up at his buddy and said, watch the first step, it's a dilly. The first step in this one, of course, is to get down to the meaning of power of being. The power of being. Now, that's got to mean something. And I would agree, too, that it does mean something. And the difficulty is, and just can we agree what it does mean and how we are using it here? People prodding around in the ruins of ancient Greece at one time found a stone tablet which told the story of a man who had had two goats stolen from him, and he wanted to sue the person who stole them to recover his goats, and he employed a lawyer, and the lawyer represented him in the action. And apparently halfway through the action, the client said to his lawyer, you've spoken very learnedly about our wars with Sparta, with Crete, and with those other cities, but isn't it now time to mention my goats? And I think until we get down to the specifics of this problem that we really can't see whether or not there is such a thing as justice which exists in a meaningful way or not. That is, as a guiding way for man's activity or not. That is, whether or not you can use it as a ruler, a yardstick, for what you do about problems such as, do you let people ride in railway trains even though they happen to be of another color? And do you let people eat in restaurants even though they don't happen to be Norwegians? And this kind of thing. Now let me go back to Paul's paper for just a moment and make a couple comments about it, reading a little bit of what he has read to you and then making some observations. The first one I'd like to make is going back to the very beginning, where he talks about whether or not a Christian may disobey unjust law. Law here, disobey an unjust law, a singular, an unjust law. What he is really saying is whether or not you may disobey a specific positive ordinance, rule, order, which is found to be undesirable, unjust, if you will. This he recognizes perhaps more accurately on the second page of his comments, where he says, in judging the justness or the unjustness of a particular positive law. Again, meaning a particular positive rule, that is, a statement about wipe your feet before you come in the house. Is it just or unjust to make this kind of requirement? I would call your attention to the fact that this body of rules, the specific statements of what you shall and shall not do, specifically, really not law as I have been using that term for you. What I have been talking about with you, and what I think we must talk about again, is law as a dynamic system for resolving problems. It's a way of resolving the problems. It's a way of thinking. And when Paul suggests that a lawyer and an economist are scientists, yes, in a way, it depends how you use that word. I usually think myself of a lawyer being more of an artist, really, than a scientist. A scientist is one who can approach pretty objective information, pretty objective truth. And a lawyer really is one who works like a violin player to evoke certain emotions and to make things happen a certain way without ever knowing whether what he has done or what he accomplishes is true or false. And now I incorporate by reference, if I may, what I have been trying to say about the fact that the lawyer's skill in resolving conflicts is usable only when you cannot resolve the conflict in some other way. People do not argue about problems where they can find the answers. If you can weigh it, measure it, test it, put litmus paper around it or something else, you don't sue each other. You finally sue and work out a compromise by art rather than by scientific knowledge. When you have no persuasive evidence going one direction or the other. But of course, this is still a little bit one side of this problem, and the problem being, well, when you work out that compromise, are you trying to match it to some eternal truth, some actual justice, capital J? Now, here I can say, yes, Paul, I agree with you. There is such a thing as a goal. There is such a thing as God's purpose for man. There is such a thing as God. And I can believe these things. I can believe these things. I frankly do not think that I can know them in any sort of a positive knowledge sense. I think just as soon as man thinks that he can prove God's existence scientifically, he is, one, a fool, and two, deceiving himself. Because to know God in the sense of being able to run him through the test tube would, of course, be to subject him to our control and thus destroy God. This means then that he, if he is truth, that he is not knowable to man, and this cannot be the yardstick by which I make these particular determinations, other than in sort of a questing, a Q-U-E-S, a questing sense, a seeking sense, a sense to be like this God that I know, that I regard as being truth, the truth which I can't quite get on top of. And this picks up Paul's last point, you see, where he says, and surely rightly, that the natural lawyer is a man who disposes much too quickly of the problem of finding out about things. It's tough enough to find out about anything. I suspect that there isn't a scientist in the world today who doesn't recognize and is willing to admit the fact that his information is terribly faulty, and he recognizes its faultiness much more acutely as the means for perceiving reality increase for him. An analogy which is helpful to me, if it is to you or not, you can judge for yourself. If you think of all of the kinds of information that are observable, or detectable information that the man can use to find out about things, imagine that as being a band of information which goes from the earth to the moon, just to have something to talk about. And suppose that all that you can perceive is what you can hear, see, smell, taste, feel, senses. I suspect that out of this band of information, which is constantly going by us, that we can pick up only a few inches of it. And obviously, this is a real distortion of truth. We call it truth because that's the way we see it. That's the way we perceive it. Well, as we begin to use microscopes and test tubes and laboratories and spaceships, we broaden the band of our perception. But man, there's a lot of it out there in the edges yet that's just whistling by, undetected and not understood. So the scientists at the university have changed the speed of light two or three times in the time that I've been changing. That's a ridiculous statement. They haven't changed the speed of light, but they've changed their measurement of it. It wasn't important for the cave age man to worry about how fast light was traveling. The problem never occurred to him. Columbus didn't even worry much about that. It worries people sick today, see? Because now if we want to try and hit Mars or someone near it, you've got to get your measurements down to more than the carpenter's three axe handles and one plug of tobacco. It simply is not a fine enough measure. Now, when we talk about human beings and their relation to each other, you've got to go through this same sort of process. There is a standard, I think, by which one tries to measure these things. You could take Paul's word justice here and put it in the lawyer's terms of constitutional. We could say, is a law just? Meaning, is it constitutional? Does it square by those standards that we have given ourselves to decide whether or not it is a, he says, a just law? I might say a constitutional law. If it is within the permissible framework of what we may do by statute or by court decision, i.e., if it's constitutional, then it's just. Because we have given ourselves a constitution which hearkens in terms not of realities, measurable realities, but rather in terms of fine rolling phrases. Created by my Creator with certain inalienable rights. Sheer gibberish. Except that we live by this as kind of a profession of faith. And I must insist that this is what, in the last analysis, I come down to. Not that God has a justice, which is law framed, but rather that God has for man here a goal, an objective, a type of existence which is not attainable to me, but which constitutes for me a fighting faith. That is one that I'll fight about. And when you say that certain people ought to be killed without certain types of procedures, this is a place where I get my hackles up. And although I cannot demonstrate scientifically, I still will fight about this because this is the place where my faith is strong enough, so I do fight. And this is, in a sense, constitutional law for a lawyer. Now, one quick comment, or at least fairly quick, about power of being again, because this one is that elevator shaft we've got to get around to get down or up the stairway, as the case may be. Power, what does the word power mean, please? I can give you my definition because lawyers work with the word power all the time. Power, to a lawyer, as we use it in our language, means the capacity or the ability to work some changes. Now, maybe that's going to be acceptable, and maybe it is not. Power has to mean something. And I say, my definition of power, the one that I use, is the ability to work some changes, and incidentally, power always has the reciprocal vulnerability on somebody else's part. You see, a right is what I can enforce or get enforced, and a duty is the guy who has to give it to me. A power is my capacity to work a change in somebody else, or in his relationship, and he is vulnerable. He cannot prevent me from doing this. I have the capacity to do it. Now take Paul's words here, power to be, or power of being. If power means the capacity to manipulate or change, to control being, would he really seriously ask me to believe that I can control my being? To be or not to be, and this is within my grasp, my power? Surely not. This cannot be the meaning of power of being, because it's the very curse of man that he cannot simply stop being. You see, you can't really stop being. Not in this life, nor in the next. You're stuck with you. You can't get away from yourself. This is man's curse, if you want to think of it in terms of curses. I suppose that if suicide, that Chris was talking about the other day, were the end of things, then man would have an out, but he doesn't have. And if man can't control this thing, then he doesn't really have a power, not a being. Now, if, on the other hand, power to be means that each one of us has in our possession, although we cannot maintain it or keep it at our own will, that is to say, it may be flicked out like this any time and we don't have the power to control it, but we do have sort of in trust or on loan or temporarily with us in a framework in which we live, a capacity to affect other people and other things, rocks, stuff. If this is what power to be means, and therefore a child does not have as much pushing power as an adult, or a person who is trained in engineering has more pushing power than one who does not have, that is, ability to do things, I am, of course, in complete agreement with this. And it is also true that some nations have more pushing power than others. But if this is all that power to be means, or power of being means, then I can say, well, sure, that's simply some horsepower that I've got on loan temporarily. And I don't really control it in terms of its final analysis. I can use it, manipulate it while it's here, but that is just plain grace. That's all. You see, it isn't mine. I just have it temporarily, which brings me around the circle again. And finally, I come back to the place where I start with this, and that is that there is God's love, which gives me this thing, which I do not control. I have no green stamps on it at all, and I can't keep it. It comes and it goes as it will, as God will. God wills that it is to happen. On the other hand, he has put me in a position where I at least have it now and I can effectuate it. How does that relate to justice? Well, it does relate to justice in this sense, that if God has given me intelligence but has not limited me in its use, if he has given me freedom, you see, then the only thing that I can see really that's objective that Paul is talking about is the existence of man's freedom. Because although man cannot exist or not exist at his will, what he can do is deny the very power that created him. Because the freedom of man means that you can deny God. In the last analysis, then, it comes down to this judgment. Will you use as well as you can, or will you not use as well as you can that capacity which God gave you? This then takes me to the last set of observations which Paul made. And that is, Paul says, the power of being is not simply the child's being compared to the adult's being, because this is also a dynamic, not a static thing. The child, after all, has potential. He will grow to be an adult, and therefore, when you're going to give him his due, the piece of the cake that he ought to have, you've got to have some of it given to him right now and some of it in the bank for the time when he grows up, sort of held in trust for him when he matures. This would mean that all people ultimately have the same amount of whatever it is we're talking about here in justice, some of it in cash in hand and some of it in the bank. But that's not enough, you see, because ultimately you must also recognize that in God's sight all human beings are potentially redeemable. Indeed, the price has been paid, and all people potentially have this capacity of being God's own select children, and therefore, in the last analysis, if you take the actual and the potential in Adam together, you're back at this, to me, completely horrible idea of complete equality and no prerogative on the right of man to make meaningful distinctions, giving some people more and some people less, because I think this is necessary in life. How does that get around to civil rights? I think very meaningfully. I think that one does not get any place by saying that a person has a right or a person has a natural justice claim to any kind of equality in the world. I don't think that he does. I think rather that human beings have an opportunity to work out a system which will work most effectively to obtain what they see as being the ideal goal. And the steps that we take with reference to persons, white, black, yellow, brown, red, whatever they may be, should be measured in terms of where we want to go, how do we get there most advantageously. The goal is our regulator. The means by which we get there, the tool, is completely within our control.
Well, I want to make just a couple of brief comments, and then let's get on to the civil rights question, because I think we are going past each other to some extent, and it's very difficult to avoid on the cloudy abstractions of power of being. I do want to say that I think the lawyer is more of a scientist, although I than Vern admits. I have no use for people, economists or lawyers. Economists are very prone to do this, who like to parade in their scientific credentials, use all the techniques used in the physical sciences, and suppose that someday they too shall attain unto that great dignity. I don't think that a social science can ever be a science in the sense in which the physical sciences are, and I abominate people who try to make it that. I think they not only waste their time, but they are usually trying to manipulate people in some fashion. They tend to be behaviorists. But there is still something hard about law. There are facts there that have to be gathered. That's why a lawyer has to go to law school for 3 years and take bar exams. The art of being a lawyer, I grant. But good art has a form. There is a difference between good art and bad art, and it inheres somehow in the nature of things. I will not concede the claim that pushpin is as good as poetry, or that Elvis Presley is as good as Bach. Really, Bach is better. In these last couple of weeks, Verne has been communicating facts to us. He's not been just playing on our emotions. He's not been just manipulating us, deceiving us. He's not been communicating mere prejudices. He was speaking of reality. He was attempting to convey knowledge, knowledge that he had acquired because he is a knowledge gatherer, which is what a scientist means. Scientia, knowledge. Now, on just one other business, this power of being. I cannot define power of being. I can only point to it and hope for intelligent recognition on your part, that you recognize in reality that to which I am pointing. I would insist that it is not the mere power to work changes. We have, unfortunately, tended to identify our power to be with our ability to work changes, as a man thinks that he is what he does. That the way I make my living is what I am. And if I cannot accomplish something, get something done, if I'm not a good Puritan, in other words, if I'm not using means to achieve ends, then I have no power, and I have no real being, and I'm nothing. Now, this is nonsense. A man can be, and be a great deal, in leisurely contemplation, not move a muscle his whole life, and still have great power to be, though he transformed nothing. It's kind of funny to hear the reality of power, the power to be, denied at a place like this, where I have never met so many people per square inch with tremendous power to be. I don't want to start naming examples, but they stick out all over this place. There are people with genuineness, with guts, with freedom, with what is it they got? They've got the courage to be what they are. And that this is grace, I will not deny. It is completely grace. Nothing else. That's the one thing that you certainly can't change, is your power to be, and hence to affect any kind of changes. But it does exist among people, and it exists in varying degrees. It is, I think, any kind of sensible and workable definition of mental health has to rely upon this. Unless we're going to just say, well, mental health is that particular neurosis shared by a majority of the population. What does Karen Horney mean by the neurotic personality of our time? She suggested that maybe most of us were nuts, and that's a distinct possibility. But then who decides what nuts is? The measure of man, Aristotle would say the essential man. What is that? It's a very difficult thing to talk about, but I know what it is. And Verne Rieke is one. That's the funny thing.
You mean nuts?
Well, now, to get the debate going, I'd like to pose a question that seemed to me to arise naturally out of what he said at the end. He said, let's see, I don't want to Well, let me just pose a question. Maybe he didn't say.
Before you pose it, could we ask if there's a possibility of clarification of general criteria here now as you move into the question? I mean, then you're going to start the debate, aren't you?
Well, we hope you're going to have the debate.
No.
We referee.
Well, you may be the referees, but I only want to be the clarifier. I'm not arguing for any point here. But now, as I understand the issues proposed now as a basis for debate on civil rights here at this point, that you are asserting something which is a possible commonality for judgment, right?
I think he is.
No, but you are, well, you both are, but each one from a different point of view. You are proposing that there is a basic premise here which can be arguable for all, independent of revelation, independent of scripture, and so on. There is this which is a universality, right? I mean, that's what a natural law means.
Yes, I would say, I would not say independent of revelation, because I would say independent of scripture. I do not think revelation is confined to scripture.
Yeah. This is how you would get around this one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm concerned here because there's a real issue here behind the truth. I don't want to argue the issue ever. Others can pick that up. I want to be the clarifier here. That's all. All my role is going to be this summer. Whereas, as I understand,
clarifies like the Missouri River, the big muddy.
Your opponent here then is arguing that the commonality which we have is a particularity which we assume and have accepted as a basis, namely constitutional criteria. Whatever may be forming those constitutional criteria is another thing. We may not even agree on the principles behind them, as I think it would be hard to find anybody in today's world who would. But we do have the Constitution formed on these various premises, and the Constitution exists. And he is saying that on the basis of this, there are certain technicalities then, or a certain kind of legal know-how, if you wish, and economic know-how, and social know-how, which operates on this kind of a commonality. But that's an imposed commonality. I mean, that's one which we impose on ourselves without trying to ascribe universality to it, which will be accepted by all men or anything like that. But this is a particularity. And then we operate with this particularity ourselves as those who have an understanding of a goal that has been given by revelation, because we see no goal as such which men may sit around and simply ascribe out of some other kind of a criteria other than that which God in his grace has given us in Christ as a goal. Is that right now? I mean, the goal that he sees.
Yes. Yeah. Is that right?
I just want this for clarity so as the debate forms, then they know that they
are. I can't say whether or not Paul got across to you. He would have to say that. That isn't quite. Maybe you said what I said. I'll try just one or two sentences to see if I can say it as succinctly as all of this. I do not think that God has given us anything which is quite so specific or concrete that we can use it as being the yardstick for particular decisions in life, which is invariable and immutable in its nature. I've tried to say this week and last week by saying that the Ten Commandments are not, to me, immutable. Now, they happen to be pretty acceptable at the moment, but it doesn't mean that they are immutable, they couldn't be changed. Rather, we must try and construct something which will be our yardstick, which will be our measure. And we have done that in sort of a almost philosophical statement, which is our Constitution. And we use that Constitution in our laws, our rules, as being the standard weight and measure against which we test the acceptability of our social rules, our laws. This Constitution is not an immutable thing. but it is deliberately phrased in terms of an imponderable thing, because we recognize in it that we do not control ourselves, but rather that we have certain rights which are inalienable, given to us by our Creator. So it becomes a sort of a sense of the people, a goal in this way. Is that about what you said,
yes,
Carol?
This is right.
Well, if I can use that terminology, and I think here's where we differ. That he says we must construct the yardstick. That's a direct quote.
Right.
I would say that the big yardstick in the sky finally measures the yardsticks we construct. But there is a, that sounds silly, but there is such a thing as an unjust constitution. Now, I'd like to pose a question, Bernard.
Just this. You see, I also agree that the big yardstick in the sky finally measures the constitution. But that finally, if you mean this chronologically, I am to be judged, of course I am to be judged. But that final truth will not, simply is not knowable to me until it's too late to use it.
Oh. All right, and we still disagree. A portion of that, I think, can be known, and we must consult it. Now, this is the practical question I wanted to pose. Is the South African system of law just?
Well, you see, it's what does the man mean by just? This is the problem. Shall I now say, does it square with the Constitution of South Africa and therefore is just? Or does he really mean to ask me when he says this, is this the way that I would have people treated under my constitution in my country? In which case I would say, no, it is not my concept of what I would like to see. The difficulty with it is that he is insisting upon using this word just, which is exactly the thing that we can't agree upon. And when we have two different definitions, I can't answer that question. Would you want me to ask whether or not it is moral? I can now give you an answer about my sense of morality. I can give you some sense answer about whether or not it has utility. This is not the question I think he's asking me. And that is it the best possible structure of law? No. If justice means, is it the best that people can do? No, I don't think so.
Is it moral? Is it moral? Put it that way.
No, I don't think it's
Why
moral.
Not?
I don't think it's moral because I, as I read Scripture, and as I understand God's love for human beings, and as I think God purposes for human beings, that is to do as he does in love, I do not see this as being the most suitable approach of one human being to love another human being. This is not to say that it is unjust. However, trying now to use unjust in the term that I think Paul would be using it, because much of what we regard as being justice is deliberately hurtful. And hurtfulness is always a violation of love. A simple illustration of that sort of thing is a guy has a barber shop, earning a nice living, another barber moves in and does a better job and takes all his business away, and the first guy dies. As an economist, Paul will tell you that's just. I think it's hurtful.
It is just and it is moral. And not everything hurtful is immoral. When a father spanks his child, that is not immoral. Much hurt must be inflicted upon people. When the President of the United States sends troops into Vietnam, he is deliberately and knowingly intending to hurt people. That is not necessarily immoral. I believe it is not, as a matter of fact, immoral. Hurt is sometimes necessary. When does hurting people become immoral? When it is not just. And what does that mean? It means when it's not appropriate. Appropriate to what? Appropriate to reality, to what really is, to the situation, the whole situation of the persons who are being hurt, and of the societies in which they live, and which they may be called upon to defend, even with their lives.
That's easy, Doctor.
Okay.
The problem with that, you see, is that he is now knowing what is God's will. And it is with his perception that he has just flopped it out on the table and says, there's what God says is moral and immoral. He is making a judgment on incomplete information. And the church has done this many, many times and has immediately become very judgmental about things that turned out to be rather foolish, silly, inaccurate, devoid of utility, and not loving at all. I don't believe that Paul Hame would happily barbecue people as Protestants did to Roman Catholics and Roman Catholics did to Protestants for a long time, all in the name of God, in order that they might go to heaven happy. And I believe these people were sincere, you see, in their belief that this was the way that God wanted them to do. I'm not questioning the honesty of their judgment, I'm questioning its accuracy. Just like I'm now suggesting that Paul also is subject to precisely that same sort of error. It's built into him. And if he wants to use morality as his judgment, as his standard, then let us recognize now that it's a pretty faulty standard. And his judgment about this may be more accurate, more perceptive than mine, but it still is far from incomplete. And I don't think, Paul, that you would claim infallibility. John?
Yes, I would.
Pius?
But you see, it always, when a person says something is immoral, it always seems that he's saying, merely, this is my opinion. Obviously, whenever I pronounce something immoral, I say, in fact, that's wrong. That is my opinion, and I may be mistaken. And explicit in what I said in this prepared paper was that admission. I said, one of the great virtues of beginning with the premise that there is a standard of justice which judges us is that we can discuss the questions rationally. Now, that always means that we admit the possibility that we are wrong, that I have incorrectly gauged the power of being of a nation or of a person, that my estimate of what will best conduce to the realization of the potentialities of the Negroes in the South. It may be quite wrong. It may even be, let me take a hard example, it may be that South Africa is moral, just, that their system, whole system of apartheid is just. That is a possibility that I will not exclude. I don't happen to hold to that view now, but I will admit room for it. That is a very complicated question. If they were not to practice rigid, unrelenting apartheid, could they avoid eventual integration? Probably not. If the South African society is eventually integrated, will the life and cultural achievements of the Boers be maintained? Probably not. If the cultural and technological and economic and social achievements of the Boers are not maintained, will the people, white and black, living in the region of South Africa be better off? In any meaningful way, perhaps not.
One question here in terms of history. I mean, since we're using the South African Constitution, it is simply an interesting footnote at this point. Doesn't help my own eventual argument where I'd argue, I'm not going to, but it should be just noted here, that the one who is responsible for this kind of a constitution in South Africa happens to be Andrew Murray, whose books, With Christ in the School of Prayer and The Secret of Adoration and so on, we have all enjoyed, and he made this judgment on the basis of power of being. That's where he got off. The Negro has less power of being than the white. This, even the scripture itself indicates, therefore, we can put this into the Constitution. This is just one interesting little
historic. Do you want to skim or shall I?
No, I want to say something to that. I think this is a very important observation. Have you ever wondered about this now? See, all good Christians nowadays, that means people like us, admit that the church has got to be integrated, and we're probably not all completely in agreement here, but society has to integrate too. Probably almost all of you would agree schools ought to be integrated. And we say that this is Christian, that's all. How come there weren't any good Christians back in 1870?
Oh, Paul.
Well, now wait a minute. I'm going to answer. That's a rhetorical question. Don't get excited about a rhetorical question. In 1870, it was believed universally, almost universally, as a matter of fact, rabid abolitionists believed this. George Washington Cable was firmly convinced of this, and he finally got booted out of the South because he was urging the necessity of sending whites and Negroes to the same schools. He took it as a matter of fact that the Negro was inferior to the white. Now, we have discovered through scientific knowledge that this ain't so. We have seen more clearly by inspecting reality that the power of being of the white and the Negro, if there is a difference, it is not perceptible. That such differences as exist are environmentally created, and that environment lies within our power to alter. That the potentiality of the Negro, and hence his full power of being, has been destroyed by segregation. But these people didn't have that knowledge of fact back in 1870, and that's why good Christians could be total segregationists. The most important cause for the development of integration in the last 20 or 30 years, I think, is increasing scientific knowledge of the realities of race.
Now?
Yeah.
You see, the difficulty with that statement is that he assumes that Christians are good. I don't think you can assume this. Neither then nor now, you see. This is the dignity, the work righteousness, the day-by-day stuff that you're getting at this point. And I don't think this follows at all. Christians can be believing, they can be non-believing. They can accept God, they can reject God. That's it. From there on out, you try, motivated by what you want to do, to try and do it properly. Another point, though, that I wanted to point out, since Paul had talked about it, one is... this appears really in a sort of related fashion in two ways. He made the mistake of writing this and giving me a copy. A law against pickpocketing does not promote the welfare of pickpockets. Quotation. Is that true? Am I to assume that the success of a pickpocket in society is a desirable goal? Or if one prevents a pickpocketing from picking a pickpocket from picking pockets. Boy, I'm glad he didn't get one by the name of Paul. Is it not for his good that we prevent him, for his welfare, for his betterment, that we prevent him, if we can, from picking pockets? And then you get around to the other side of this thing, where he says, here's the position to which I find myself finally committed a little bit, and then what this means in practice is, A, justice is finally not a human creation, and of course we think about that not knowing quite what we mean by justice, perhaps. It is finally not our judgment, but a judgment upon us. Now, he comes awfully close here to what would be acceptable to me. And that is that what we have done with the gifts that God gave us in the last analysis will be judged by God. And in this sense, even now, you see, what we do, our conduct, as I see it, is judged. But justice cannot simply be a judgment. I don't think in any meaningful sense, justice as a yardstick cannot be simply a judgment about something which has happened historically, because now you have a question of man's guidance coming in here. How do you handle that, Paul? Justice cannot be simply a judgment in the sense of looking at something that's happened and saying that was good or that was bad, that was acceptable, that was not acceptable. Judgment in the sense of guidance must be man's ability to make determinations. It must be, here I'm going to have to decide how to do this, and therefore I need my ruler out there to guide me. But that is not God's judgment on what we have decided to do. Judgment is the statement which God finally says, goats and sheep, this kind of thing, in our daily living. That doesn't have prospective utility, does it?
Don't you sit there, man. Get up and say something.
I can't answer that.
Well, let me talk some more then.
If you ever get a guy on a mat, stomp on him, quick. If what we are looking for is some standard to help us make determinations, this board will fit or this board won't fit because my guessing stick says it's so many feet and inches, this kind of thing. I think this must be in terms that we can bring down to us, and now I've got to whip out the next paper, the paper again, because Paul finally saw his own dilemma and talked about it, because when he gets through with this, this is where I finally, I find myself finally committed, and he goes through A and B, and then he says, if you buy this, you've not really solved any problems. And I would agree with him. Because what he, I think, is trying to say here is, well, when you recognize that God's judgment comes upon what we have done with what he's given us, you haven't really shown any means by which man can determine what to do about whether or not to let Negroes ride in the front or the back of the bus. That's a determination which is going to have to be made on some other standards rather than what God will ultimately do with it. Now, if we are saying that what God will ultimately do with it, I am in my own mind thinking that I have caught enough of the Spirit of God so that I think this would be the way God would handle this situation, and I would like to do it this way too, and therefore I will try and construct my rules to go that same direction. This then gives me guidance, but notice that it has that real big step in there of my perception of what God would think about it. Someone of you kind people left over on the dresser where I'm staying, Greater Works opened up to a cartoon of the baseball umpire, and there it is again, see, the baseball umpire talks to the two guys having an argument and says, I have a suggestion, what would Jesus say about it? Well, that's my perception again, you see, of how it would work out.
Yeah, but you know, you talk about the non-utility of my approach. Now, what about yours? You say, this is my perception of the will of God, and somebody else says, this is my perception, and bang, they conflict. And historically, that has happened, and we've had terrible religious wars about that. Now, the funny thing, and I think it should be noted here, is that at least as I have listened to Vern these last 2 weeks, on the concrete issues, he and I don't differ by yay much. And you can begin at quite different positions and come out at the same place. So why argue then about principles? You know, why go back to the beginning? I believe
By the same token, though, Paul, neither one of us would agree with Pope John, you see, and this is why it's so very important to have this much of the distinction made.
Yeah. Well, you see, if you and I ever have a chance to debate these issues with Pope John,
well, I think we'll be there. I hope he made it.
I'm sure he will. trouble is, we will all see the correctness of my position then. No, but if Pope John were living, we had had an opportunity to debate this with him. I really think that Verne would have antagonized him, and he would have written Verne off as another one of these, what's your buddy, the Viennese?
Hans Kelsen.
Yeah, Hans Kelsen. You know, he's one of these positivists, one of these guys who was responsible for Hitler. You've seen Roman Catholic. This is always their complaint against Verne's position. But I don't think that's really Verne's position. And Verne himself attacked Hans Kelsen. He doesn't accept Hans Kelsen's position that law is finally, when a just law is finally whatever works best, you know. That won't do, finally. And what will do? There's got to be some way by which people can settle differences about what ought to be without fighting. I think we all, and this includes Verne, operate with the notion that there is a distinction between right and wrong. Now, you might say, yeah, but that's the will of God. We can't consult that. Well, some might say, well, we can go to the Bible. Yeah, but you know, people have gone to the Bible, they haven't agreed either. All kinds of things in the Bible that we don't do, especially in the Old Testament. How do you judge? Which biblical injunctions are we still to obey, and which are we not to obey? I think that the Roman Catholics are correct in insisting that there is something in the nature of things which, in principle at least, all men are capable of consulting. And you see, if you accept that, then you are always hopeful about rational discussion. You're always willing to sit down with the other guy and try to show him, logically, by pointing to more evidence, by agreeing on further inquiry. You don't have to finally just shoot at him.
Maybe some of these people would like to shoot at us.
Yeah, my floor is the floor is open.
I would like to know, what is this general revelation to which you are referring outside of Scripture that gives you your criteria? I mean, since admittedly God is not limited to Scripture, but at least I am at this moment, I would like to know what other kind of revelation I get for this criteria of fullness of being. What is the revelation?
Carol, I think that's going to get us more, it's going to keep us in this abstract area.
Really,
how about
like
you and I? You and I should talk about that sometime. You see, my notion of reason includes the element of revelation. I do not. This weird notion of reason that we have, that it's completely something which we do, and that there's nothing given to us, strikes me as just opposed to everything that we experience and we know.
Let's put it this way: a question.
You rouse the sleeping bear.
Gentlemen, you two, you theologians, I think when Romans talks about the heathen as also having revealed to him, he sees the stars in the world, and he recognizes the existence of God and order. Now, the problem that I see between you two gentlemen right at the moment, I think, is Hinderly saying that what the heathen has in the rocks and trees, he knows there is order there also, but he sees no love. And I suppose maybe someone else, I don't know, I shouldn't ascribe these positions, but it seems to me the other side of that is to say that somehow, other than in Scripture, the man can also feel something of the guidance or love of God, which I suppose most of us would say is not true. Now, accurate perception here is neither one of these things, obviously. What is accurate here is that when God gave law, the law, to people, it didn't mean Ten Commandments. It meant this sense of being able to regulate and structure and work out compromises by some sort of use of ration. This is the gift that God gave us. It wasn't the Ten Commandments which was the wonderful gift. I'm not knocking them. I don't want to leave that feeling at the moment. They're pretty good. But this was not the gift of God in the law. The gift of God in the law was the system, the ability. Here, the ability to work out pretty good compromises. Not totally right or totally wrong, because this we can't know, but still getting there.
My kids say day by day and every way we're getting better.
Well, let's bring it down to specific, just to help bring them up now, on the Negro and the civil rights issue, which gets confused in this whole argument on the element of competence in the relationship, which you say science has now shown and which I certainly accept. And yet, the element of competence and the particularity is still there because of the denial of society to him, of these tools of developing this potential, whatever you want to call it, your power of being, if you wish, I just call it his potential competence. In the civil rights situation, which is confronting us now, do you simply then, in this terrific struggle is now on in our own country, neglect these aspects of competence in discussing rights independent of it?
Yeah, well, my position would imply the answer, no, you do not. But you never consider only the present competence. These systems which we are beginning to enact into positive law now for assuring complete equality of treatment of all people are becoming unjust by my standard of justice, which refers always to the power of being of individuals. People are not equal. It's an empirical fact.
What would you have done, Paul?
We have to work out uneasy compromises requiring a great deal of art.
May I make a suggestion to you? I wonder if Paul's concept of justice would accommodate this possibility, which I personally believe is the way that we should structure our law now with reference to the Negro. I don't believe that the Negro is entitled to equal treatment with a white person in the United States today. I believe that we ought to form our laws in such a way that he does not have the same chance at a job that a white person does, that he does not have the same opportunities to be aided to find good housing that a white person does. I do not believe that he ought to be given equal treatment in this way. I think that if we are to act with love toward the Negro, that he must be given a better job opportunity than the white person, that we must insist that his schooling be accelerated beyond that which we are willing to give to the white person, because this gentleman starts, this Negro gentleman starts at a place where he's got to travel further faster in order to get to the place where he can enjoy on a same plane as we. And therefore, I would argue vehemently against equality in treatment for this man. I think it must be preferential treatment. And I think that the time has long since come and gone by and is waiting impatiently for us to recognize that our treatment of the Negro must not be one of 6 inches for us and 6 inches for him, but rather must be one where we say to him in all love, brother, you need more of this than I. And therefore, I am going to structure my law in such a way that I give it to you. Now, will your sense of justice accommodate this also?
Yes. Yeah. I also hold to the necessity for preferential treatment for the Negro. That's a matter, though, of treating the Negroes. There's another kind of situation that arises. Let's say you've got a certain job that needs to be filled. Let's say it's important. Say it's a school teacher in a certain area. You need a good teacher to accelerate the education of the Negro students. You've got two teachers, one Negro and one white. The white is a terrific teacher, proven teacher. Really is going to be able to do the job. And the Negro is not. And so you say, well, perfect equality of treatment here, we'll put the Negro in. That's the kind of equal treatment which bothers me. Treating people equally just as a matter of wooden principle, without considering the the full nature of what we're doing, and we're doing that to some extent. There's another little problem here. Maybe I shouldn't introduce it, because I do believe, as Vern says, in the necessity for preferential treatment, 8 inches for them and 6 inches for the whites right now. The trouble is that when you get down to cases, it isn't white people who have the advantage, but the majority of white people have a lot of advantages. And it isn't all Negroes who are disadvantaged, but the majority of Negroes have substantial disadvantages. Now, here's a white guy, let's say, who's had all the hard knocks, too, and he needs a job. He comes along, tries to get it, and he makes every effort to qualify himself, and he gets beaten out for the job by a Negro who's given preferential treatment. Is that just? You know, it's kind of as if we, upper middle class people, comfortably fixed, are saying, we whites must make tremendous sacrifices for the Negro. And now we will so structure things in our society that the poor whites make all those sacrifices. This is a real danger. It's a pressing problem. Yeah, that could be, and that's the kind of sacrifice I would be willing to urge upon my white business friend, where he, as an advantaged person, is now himself making a sacrifice.
What about your children in school? I mean, would you be willing to, and I take the devil's advocate here,
No.
When is he ever going to get the experience to become a better teacher?
Well, how unfit is he? Well, I mean, this is the question. I would tolerate more unfitness in a Negro than in a white, but there's a limit. Well, you know, the one answer, this isn't a direct answer to your question, but I would be willing to sacrifice my children to some extent by putting them in an inferior school under an inferior teacher, in the belief that this would be in part my sacrifice too, and that that it would not be unjust to them because they could do it, they could make it. They could overcome this. They become less as a result of it, finally. But I'm very leery about imposing this upon someone else, you know? This is the trouble that...
Yeah.
I have a question, possibly, to Professor Reed. How far should we give the Negro professional treatment? How much should we increase his power of being, in contrast to the Negro pulling himself up by his own bootstraps?
Certainly not to the place where it is, lawyers like the word reasonably and unreasonably, where our sense of utility tells us that it is now destroying more good than it is doing. Every decision has to be made in light of the conflicting claims. I think if Paul and I sat down and talked for a moment about his answer, it's always easier to think when you're listening than when you're talking. story about lawyers that way. You know, the other guy had two lawyers and you only had one, and you complained because you said when his lawyer is talking up there, he's got somebody sitting down thinking, and when you're talking, nobody's thinking. I don't think that Paul and I would have any difficulty at arriving at a little modification in his answer. For example, must a businessman really give preferential employment to a Negro if it's damaging to his business? How damaging? We would not want to destroy the efficiency of our productive capacity. We would not want to destroy the efficiency of our system. At least I am almost positive that we would agree on this. We would say, why ask this kind of a question when the question you ought to ask is, could we not take some of the profit that we would make in the more efficiently run business, divert it over into education for this guy so that he would become equally fit, train the school teacher in the same sense? Now, if your answer to that one is no, this guy's got two left hands and he never will be efficient, and this school teacher never can be a school teacher in terms of efficiency, then we would not, I would not use him in this position at all. The preference that I would give to the Negro is that if he is equally able, I would prefer him for a while. If he is not equally able, then I would say let's prefer him in training or in getting ready for the position that he can occupy. I don't see this as being a matter of destroying the efficiency of our society. At least I wouldn't do that.
Sounds like you would support that, bussing them. You don't want them to live together, but you do want them to go to school together.
I